So I was in the middle of calculating the three-point function of zeta using results from the Maldacena paper. And following Maldacena, I'm doing the calculation in this mysterious zeta C gauge. Where you relate zeta nonlinearly to a field zeta C. Wouldn't it be great if I had some sort of intuitive physical explanation of what zeta C represents? Well, I don't. I just know that it's a change of variables that makes the action simple. So the quadratic action is, of course, the same as the quadratic action for zeta, and the cubic action, according to Maldacena, looks like this. So I'm going to calculate the quantum mechanically produced three-point function coming from this interaction in the interaction picture. So first, I like to convert all of my phi dots and phi double dots and so on to slow roll parameters. So I did that. I have a little cheat sheet of formulas that just tells me how to do this conversion, and the tutorial I gave you my cheat sheet and had you derive them. So here's what I get. Let me start processing this action by first. Oh, this should have been dt. By first converting to slow roll parameters and also converting to conformal time. So phi dot to the fourth over h cubed becomes 4 epsilon squared h. I get a cubed when I convert to conformal time. The dt brings out an a, and each, oh, this should have been zeta dot squared. And then each time derivative brings down a 1 over a. So using primes to denote conformal time derivatives, this is the action. Now you might, to run the interaction picture, we need the interaction Hamiltonian. And you might say, well, in general, if I add an interaction to a Lagrangian, the interaction Hamiltonian is just the interaction with the sign flipped because, you know, the Hamiltonian has the minus L in it. That's true. This formula is correct, but I think it's sort of non-obvious. The reason I think it's non-obvious, so it would be obvious if there were no time derivatives here. But the way the Hamiltonian is defined, you're really supposed to define it in terms of x's and p's, where p's come from differentiating the action with respect to zeta dot. So because there are time derivatives here, that changes the definition, the relation between p and x dot at second order. So this is true, but not obvious. So, just to show you why it's true, let me show schematically, just for the case of a single classical degree of freedom. If I had this Lagrangian, this is only a calculation to first order in the interaction. Let me show you it's true that the Hamiltonian is what you might naively write down the Hamiltonian where I just have the free Hamiltonian here and then I just change the sign of the x dot term. Let's check that that's true. If we run the steps to get from the Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian, so first there's a momentum defined by differentiating the Hamiltonian with respect to x dot, that's x dot plus 3 alpha x dot squared. To leading order in alpha, you can invert this and say that x dot is p minus 3 alpha p squared. And then the Hamiltonian, so to get the Hamiltonian, first I compute px dot minus l, and then I change variables. I compute this as a function of x and x dot, and then I change variables from x dot to p. So px dot minus l is 1/2 x dot squared plus 1/2 omega squared x squared plus 2 alpha x dot cubed. There's a 3 here minus 1 here that gives a coefficient of 2. And then if I convert from x dot to p, I can just replace x dot by p in the last step because that term has a power of alpha. Then this does indeed work out to 1/2 px squared, 1/2 p squared plus 1/2 omega squared x squared minus alpha p squared. And the same calculation with a bunch more baggage with, instead of just one degree of freedom x dot, a whole field's worth of freedom and some factors of k and integrals on the outside works. So this is true, but it's only true to first order. If I were calculating, say, to fourth order in the fluctuations, then I wouldn't just take minus of the interaction that appears in the cubic Lagrangian. There would be more terms. You can also show that this is generally true for any function of x dot and x here. That if you put any function of x and x dot here, the interaction Hamiltonian is just related by flipping the sign and naively substituting p's for x dots. So there's nothing magical about the x dot cubed. But to higher order, it's not true. Okay. Now let's work out the interaction Hamiltonian. For the calculation, it's going to be convenient to write this in Fourier space. Interaction Hamiltonian is minus epsilon. I should have written the interaction Hamiltonian without the d tau here and made this hi of tau on the left-hand side. Okay. So here's the interaction Hamiltonian. Let's write it in Fourier space. So this real space multiplication of three quantities will become an integral over three, let me call them k primes for future reference. Times a delta function. And what I'll have here is two zeta primes, and then this delta to the minus 2 becomes minus 1 over k squared. So I get a zeta prime k3 over k3 squared with a minus sign that I'll just bring to the outside here. Okay. Now let's run the interaction picture. So I want to compute at late times the expectation value of three zetas. By the interaction picture, that's minus I times the integral prime. So the interaction picture formula says that the NN formula says that you commute the observable, in this case, this product of three zetas, with the interaction Hamiltonian at the earlier time. Um, Since both of these operators are Hermitian, the commutator just gives I can remove the commutator. I'll write the interaction Hamiltonian out in a second. And put plus cc at the end, the term with the commutator switch just gives the complex conjugate. So the interaction Hamiltonian is integral d3 k1 prime. Pi to the 9. Oh. This 2 pi cubed should have been 2 pi to the 9, of course. Okay. 4 epsilon h a cubed. These k's should also be primes. Let's put the k cubed here. K prime square. Zeta prime k3 prime times 2 pi cubed dot the 3 sum k. Okay. Now I'm just going to evaluate this vacuum expectation value by Wick's theorem. These zeta primes are all evaluated at time tau prime. So one term, I'll just calculate one term and then put the other terms in at the end. It would be given by contracting, say, k1 with k1 prime, k2 with k2 prime, k3 with k3 prime. Okay. So this gives minus I times the integral epsilon squared h cubed. Recall that the interaction picture operator for zeta at wave number k. I'm defining the mode function u by this statement. So in terms of those mode functions, I apply Wick's theorem. I keep the coefficient of a in the left part of each contraction. Those mode functions are evaluated at time tau. And then I have mode functions at and tau prime here. Yeah, and then the delta function, you know, 1/k3 squared. The delta functions and integrals just work out to give a 2 pi cubed delta 3 sum of ki at the end. That's one contraction. And then there are 5 more contractions related by permutations. Yes?
Should this use be differentiated?
Oh, yes, you are absolutely right. This should be u star. Thanks. Thanks. Okay, so then that's one contraction. There are 5 more contractions just given by, just related by symmetry. So one of the 5 gives the same thing, so I'll put in a factor of 2. And the other 2 just give, since the rest of the integrand is symmetric, just give this. There's plus cc. Okay. So to get a look at, so that's an exact formula for the 3-point function. To get a look at the leading behavior in slow roll, I'm just going to evaluate this integral in the with the approximation of De Sitter mode functions. So at lowest order in slow roll, I'm going to use my De Sitter mode functions, which are u is equal to h over 2 epsilon to the 1 half k to the 3 halves. This factor, minus ik tau. The derivative is, you can remember this prefactor because it's what you need to get the power spectrum to work out. You just square it, get the power spectrum. The derivative is h over 2 epsilon to the 1 halves k to the 1 half tau e to the minus ik. And I take A to be minus 1 over h tau. That's the De Sitter approximation. Okay. So let's plug that in. I get minus I times integral 0. So this becomes 4 epsilon squared h minus 1 over h cubed. Tau prime cubed? I probably should have written a prime here to indicate that it's the scale factor at time t prime, because it not tau prime, not tau, because it came from the interaction Hamiltonian. Tau prime cubed. These mode functions, so let's see, each mode function, each u comes with an h over 2 epsilon to the 1 half, k to the 3 halves. Each u prime comes with the same factor over times 1 power of k. So let me collect all of those factors and put h to the 6 over 64 epsilon cubed k1 squared, k2 squared, k3 squared. Times a tau. So I've taken the limit tau goes to 0 in this step. Tau prime cubed e to the I sum of ki tau prime. Yeah. Times 2 over k1 squared. Okay, so in this step, I'm just rearranging algebraically without actually doing the integral. So if I just collect everything, I get h to the 4th times the sum over. So one way of one nice way of writing this is the sum over. Something seems wrong here. Let me stare at this for a sec. Oh yeah, okay. So this should have been k to the 1 half. And these should have been single powers of k. Okay. So a way of writing this. Which parallels Maldacena if I collect everything is like this. Okay. The integral on the inside here. The way I actually so formally what you do is you analytically continue. You define tau prime equals minus I tau e prime, where tau e prime goes from minus infinity to zero. The way I remember it, I actually remember what to do, is that the shorthand way that I actually remember it is that if this were a real number, a, then the integral would just be 1 over a. And so the analytic continuation is just given by putting 1 over a. If you plug that in, so you get something real here, so the plus cc just adds a factor of 2. You get this. Okay, so that's the last piece missing in our calculation of what I've actually calculated here is the three-point function of zeta c. The three-point function of zeta. Is equal to the three-point correlator. So one term is just the three-point correlator of three zeta c's. And then there were terms coming from the zeta c squared and this other quadratic piece that we calculated last time. So if we put those in with their respective coefficients of 3 epsilon over 4 minus 8 over 2 and epsilon over 2, then you get this expression. So the term that we just calculated. The terms from yesterday with the right coefficients. At numerous places, we use the slow roll approximation. So this is just true to leading order and slow roll. Let me just do one more line to write this the way that Maldacena writes it. So this, just have it in the same form as Model Sandy. So this is a famous calculation. I mean, this is the first complete calculation at leading order and slow roll for the three-point function that you expect from single field slow roll inflation. Since epsilon and eta are the parameters that we measure from the scalar tilt NS and the tensor scalar ratio R, this gives a characteristic signal. I mean, once those parameters are pinned down in the two-point function, the three-point function is completely predicted as a function of the three Ks. So if this were large enough to be observable, which unfortunately we'll see shortly is dubious, it would be a really fantastic thing to measure. I mean, if you could actually measure this and see the detailed K dependence, that would be a really strong confirmation of single field slow roll inflation. I'm going to discuss the physics in this result and interpret it a little bit. I mean, first off, I guess one general comment is that at a conceptual level, all of this monster calculation that we all suffered through for the last few days is really just calculating this vertex, this Feynman vertex between three zetas and evaluating this diagram. It's sort of peculiar, the general relativity. I mean, we started with like the simplest, you know, nicest looking 4D covariant action in the world, this action. There's just something about general relativity that makes this formula very resistive, like algebraically resistive, to being put in the form that's appropriate for QFT calculations, with the physical degrees of freedom identified, expanded to quadratic order in some sort of leading free term, and then with a cubic interaction piece that's calculated to lowest order. The fact that what you're trying to do here is so conceptually simple but so complicated algebraically makes me wonder if there's something that we're missing here, if there's some shortcut through all of this algebra. All I could say is that I certainly didn't see anything like that when I went through the paper, and no one else has either. But it's something that I think is interesting to wonder about. You can interpret this formula. There's an interesting interpretation of this formula in the so-called squeeze limit, where one of the k's is much smaller than the other two. We sometimes draw these little triangles to represent configurations of endpoint functions, since the endpoint functions always contain, since they always contain it, I sometimes forget to write it, this translation invariance preserving delta function. So we sometimes draw these little pictures. Let me draw you a different cartoon. The squeeze three-point function, the three-point function in this limit, if I were to say that that is large, then what I would be saying is that the modes of the zeta field look something like this. So here's a long wavelength mode of zeta that short wavelength fluctuations are going to ride on top of. Their small scale power spectrum amplitude is different here than it is here. This would not be true for a Gaussian field where the long wavelength modes and short wavelength modes are statistically independent. Why is this cartoon saying the same thing as saying that the three-point function is large in this limit? Well, what we're saying in the cartoon, what we're depicting in the cartoon, is a situation where the small-scale power, the locally measured small-scale power on some scale k2, is correlated with a long wavelength mode on some long scale k1. Since power is a quadratic quantity, we're talking about a correlation between two powers of the field on some small scale and one power of the field on some large scale, i.e. a three-point function in this configuration. Another way of saying it is that In the limit, you could imagine, well, okay, let me first write out what the squeeze limit is. So if I take the limit, let me show you the thing that I'm trying to explain. So if I take the limit where k1 is much smaller than k2 in the above expression, then by a little bit of straightforward algebra, you get this. Note that in this limit, k2 is equal to k3. Now, you might notice that this can be expressed in terms of the zeta power spectrum, which is h squared over 4 epsilon k cubed, and its deviation from scale invariance, which we defined to be ns minus 1. So the definition of this was it was the derivative of log k cubed p of k over p log k. This k cubed p of k is the combination that's constant for a scale invariant field. This we found to be 6 epsilon minus 2 eta. No, with a minus sign. This is equal to minus deviation from scale invariance times 2 copies of the power spectrum. And that's not a coincidence. There's a nice physical argument related to this picture. I want to explain that. I'm not claiming to. So this is actually true for any single field model of inflation, even models whose action is very different from the single field Sorel action that we wrote down. And I won't claim to prove that rigorously, but I'll just sort of offer a physical explanation. It's possible to define the notion of the locally measured small scale power on a scale k2. So you can imagine that I've defined, let me call it P loc k2, which is the power spectrum that an observer would measure if their observations are confined to a little box. And because that box can move around, this is a field. And so I can Fourier transform that field and evaluate its Fourier transform on some scale k1. So what this represents is the locally measured power at scale k2 Fourier transform to scale k1. So this squeeze 3-point function is equal to, you can also think of it as, you can factor it into a composition of two 2-point functions by defining this quantity and then asking whether it's correlated to zeta on large scales. Now, if you think physically about what's happening in the squeeze limit, this is the limit where one of the modes is generated at a much earlier time than the other. So the mode k1 is generated many Hubble times before the mode k2. And it's exited the horizon and become classical. So when the mode k2 is quantum mechanically generated, that mode just sees zeta k1 as some sort of classical background. Now, because inflation is single field, the only difference between a region where zeta is positive and a region where zeta is negative, once those modes have exited the horizon, they just look like part of the background. Locally, in this unitary gauge that we're using, the only difference between a zeta greater than zero region and a zeta less than zero region is that there's this factor in the metric. You could think of it as a constant factor. So all that means is that a local observer that lives here just sees a overall scaling of the space part of their metric. But that just means there's some global difference. There's some overall difference between the physical ruler that they use to measure things and the global coordinate ruler that a super observer, you know, who sees this whole picture and uses this metric everywhere is using. An observer that lives in this box doesn't realize that they have a zeta. They can just define it away by rescaling their coordinate system. An observer that lives in this box will see, because zeta is just some change in ruler that can be gauged away, will see exactly the same physics as an observer that lives in this box. In particular, when the fluctuation K2, zeta K2, is generated at a later time, they'll see the same power spectrum. So in this cartoon, the physically measured power spectrum, you know, that an observer that lives here and uses physical rulers measures, is the same as the physically measured power spectrum here. And so you might think then that we've argued that this three-point function is zero in the squeeze limit. And that's almost true. But there's one nuance here, which is that because the power spectrum you know, is a dimensionful quantity and it can also run with scale, when we write down the three-point function, we're talking about the cross-correlation between zeta and the coordinate power spectrum that a super observer measures in a global coordinate system. And there's some difference between the coordinate power spectrum and the physical power spectrum that we need to keep track of. So to keep track of that difference, so to keep track of that difference, imagine that I have a box. Let's just talk about one box where zeta lives. And I have two coordinate systems. So a primed observer who measures in a rescaled coordinate system. Let's say that the primed observer's coordinates are slightly rescaled, so that what they call length, with their notion of length, is 1 plus some small factor times the unprimed length. So that just scales k's in the opposite sense. How does it scale the power spectrum? So if the primed observer measures the power spectrum at subscale k prime, how is that related to the unprimed power spectrum? Well, the power spectrum is a quantity with units of volume. Zeta is dimensionless, but zeta k is defined by this integral that has volume in it, and then the two-point function, that's two volumes on the left-hand side, but the delta function here has a volume. So the power spectrum has units of volume. And so you might imagine that power scales like this. And you'd be absolutely right, except for one little difference, which is that I evaluate the unprimed observer would think that the primed observer is evaluating the power spectrum at a different scale. They would think that the k prime here is really 1 plus epsilon times k prime. So let's write that like this. Now dpdk, we can convert that to our standard notation. The spectral index, well, we defined it not quite as dpdk, but we defined it to be this. Which is 3 plus k over p times dpdk. So plugging that in, we get the following transformation lie. I get 1 plus 3 epsilon p plus k epsilon times minus k over p in front, over k in front, times minus 3 plus ns minus 1. The 3s here cancel. And I'm just left with 1 plus epsilon ns minus 1. In particular, the scale invariant case where ns is equal to 1 is the case where the power spectrum doesn't scale, doesn't change under rescaling. Okay. So if we plug that in here, so in a region where zeta is positive, say, the coordinate lengths. So this equation says that physical lengths are 1 plus zeta times coordinate lengths. So the coordinate length will be related to the physical length with a factor of 1 minus zeta. And by this transformation law, the power spectrum here, you know, that a super observer measures in global coordinates will be 1 minus zeta ns minus 1 times, let's say, p bar for the average power. Okay, so there is this small difference proportional to the deviation from scale invariance in the amount of coordinate power to distinguish between coordinate power and physical power in these two regions. Now, if I imagine computing this correlation, I take the level of small-scale power measured in global coordinates, think of that as a field that can vary, and correlate it with zeta, then, you know, if I just heuristically use this formula, I get, let's say I have a minus ns minus 1. When I correlate this zeta with the zeta, you know, that appears as a coefficient here, I get p zeta k1. And then I have this p zeta here. Which is the thing that I was trying to explain. So this is an example of something called a consistency relation. There are many theorems of this type. So it's true. I didn't really give a general proof of it. I just sort of offered this intuitive explanation. It's true in any model of single field inflation. True generally. True in any single field model. So measuring measuring a deviation from this relation between the squeezed three-point function and the tilt of the power spectrum would rule out all single models of inflation. That would be a really powerful observation. There are other theorems of this type that all have a flavor where on the left-hand side, you have an endpoint function and some special limit. And on the right-hand side, you have endpoint functions of lower order times slow roll parameters. The physical meaning of these consistency relations is always the statement that local observers that live in causally disconnected parts of the inflationary universe see the same local physics. If they just measure all their observables with physical rulers and clocks, they always get the same number. So whenever the consistency relations come up, you know, at conferences or something, there's always people raising their hands complaining about how it's really zero on the right-hand side and there's no physics in it. Well, that's sort of true. I mean, you might think that this is more of a gauge artifact, but it can't really be gauged away. There's no global coordinate system, as far as I know, where you literally get zero on the right-hand side. And it does have an observable consequence. If you were to calculate some gauge invariant observable where there's no ambiguity, like the three-point function that you see in the CMB, in some sort of squeezed limit where the wavelength of one of the temperature modes is much larger than two of the other temperature modes that are entering the three-point correlation, this would produce a term. You know, there would be a term in that full gauge invariant expression proportional to this. So this is something that we can try to observe or see deviations from. Whether you want to call it something that's morally zero or morally non-zero, I suppose is not really a very well-defined issue. Okay. Let's talk about detectability of these three-point functions. Let's warm up with a question in probability theory. So I have a 1D Gauss, a 1D random variable with a nearly Gaussian distribution of width sigma. So I just have a 1D classical random variable x with variance sigma. I may or may not, someone may or may not have put a small skewness into this distribution. Some skewness kappa where for the following formulas to be good approximations, kappa should be less than sigma cubed. How many random samples from this distribution do you need from a nearly Gaussian distribution are needed to detect the presence of non-zero skewness? Say at one sigma. I'm going to find a formula for this number n in terms of kappa and sigma. One language for answering this question would be the one statistical language would be the language of estimators. So if I have n samples, and I want to know whether there's a mean x cubed, I just average the x cubed of all my samples, and that's some estimator for kappa. Estimator for kappa just means that the expectation value of this E is equal to kappa. What's the error bar in that measurement? The expectation value of E squared, let's work that out. So this is a double sum.
I cubed x to the cubed.
If I want to calculate this to leading order in kappa over sigma cubed, then I can just take the term of zeroth order, i.e. the Gaussian expectation value, where I compute the Gaussian expectation value of this six-way product by Wick's theorem. So by Wick's theorem, the sum end here is, if I write it out, xi, 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 xj, 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 then if I is equal to j, there's a bunch of different contractions I can do. But if I is unequal to j, there are no non-zero contractions. So I get a delta ij here times the result of doing a contraction, which is sigma to the sixth, times a combinatorial factor, the number of contractions, which is 15. Okay, so the RMS error of this measurement, take the sum over delta ij just gives a factor of n, is equal to the square root of 15 over n times sigma cubed. I detect, I can detect the kappa signal, the skewness signal at one sigma. Detection at one sigma happens when kappa is larger than its error bar, which is root 15 over n sigma cubed. And that can be rearranged to say that, let me write the result like this, that n to the minus 1/2. I'm not going to keep track of parametric factors like the root 15 in this discussion of detectability. Just say that the detection happens when n to the minus 1/2 is greater than kappa over sigma cubed. Where this expression on the right-hand side is this, in statistics, would be what's called referred to as a signal-to-noise ratio. I'll sometimes write it as S over N. Okay, so what's happening here is that a single sample has signal-to-noise kappa over sigma cubed, a small number, and to beat that small number, I need a large number of samples which scales as the minus 2 power of the signal-to-noise. By the way, if you enjoy playing with this sort of thing, let me offer you a puzzle. This estimator that I wrote down is not the optimal, i.e. minimum variance of estimator for kappa. And one can write down a better estimator such that the 15 here is replaced by 6. Now that we know how to detect skewness in a nearly Gaussian field, we can think about how to or a nearly Gaussian random variable. We can think about how to detect a three-point correlation function in a nearly Gaussian field. A full discussion would go through an analogous derivation where you build estimators out of modes of a field. But let me just summarize the answer. Suppose that you're looking for a three-point correlation function. And let's suppose that let me ask, how many modes of zeta, if I could directly observe zeta in the initial conditions without it being processed through the CMB, how many modes of zeta Do you need to measure? How many Fourier modes? To measure some three-point function. Zeta, zeta, zeta. At 1 second. Let's say, instead of measure, let's say detect. The answer turns out to be that the number of modes n is given by, so it's schematically a formula like this. Where this expression on the right-hand side is the signal-to-noise ratio, would again be the signal-to-noise ratio for a single mode. This formula, as written, is not dimensionally correct. The power spectrum, as we said before, has units of volume, so the denominator would have units of length cubed, and the numerator would have, for the three-point function, the same dimensional analysis shows that the three-point function has units of length to the sixth. So what I really mean when I write the right-hand side is that I remove the factors of k. I remove an overall scaling that's like 1 over k to the sixth from the numerator, and I remove the overall scaling, which will be like 1 over k to the ninth from the denominator. I've also glossed over the issue of, since the three-point function depends on the configuration, on which k1, k2, k3, exactly where you evaluate it, since that will change the answer by an order 1 factor. If you're just calculating parametrically, i.e. not worrying about order 1 factors, then you just want to evaluate this at some generic configuration where the k's are of the same order of magnitude. If you wanted to calculate exactly the signal-to-noise for a real three-point function, there's some integral which you can derive along the lines of our derivation up here where you integrate over all the k's. But this is all, I don't want to get too bogged down in like a discussion of CMV data analysis. I just want to do sort of a parametric analysis, dropping factors of order 1. Our calculation of zeta, 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 let me write the results sort of schematically as h to the fourth over epsilon squared k to the sixth times a term which is order epsilon plus a term which is order eta. The two-point function is, you know, parametrically h squared over k over epsilon k cubed. So the criterion for detectability, like the number of modes of the CMB we would need to observe, is parametrically this, the signal to noise ratio on the right-hand side, which works out to be h epsilon to the minus 1/2 times the term of order epsilon is the term of order eta. The combination h over epsilon to the 1/2 happens to be the measured RMS amplitude of the scalar fluctuations. So this number is like the square root of 2.2 times 10 to the minus 9. So if this number is a few times 10 to the minus 5, and these numbers are of order 10 to the minus 2, because we have measured ns and we have limits on r, then what you get here is a number of the order few times 10 to the minus 7. That is the signal to noise of a single mode of zeta if you want to detect this three-point correlation. What this means, taking the n to the minus 1/2, is that the number of modes that you'd have to measure to see this three-point correlation is of order 10 to the 13, which is much larger than the number of modes that we've seen for the CMB. So for comparison, the number of modes in the CMB, you know, if we sort of crudely think of the statistical errors of the CMB as letting us measure up to some maximum L, L max, then the number of modes is the sum from L equals 2 to L max of 2L plus 1, which is L max squared. I suppose L max squared minus 4, I think, but parametrically L max squared, which for is currently at around 10 to the 7. L max is a few times 10 cubed. So we're quite a ways short. And this is a very futuristic signal to ever think about measuring. Although I personally don't think it's totally crazy if you think about the long-term future of cosmology. The number of modes, so the number of modes that's in principle measurable in our Hubble volume is actually much larger than this. And there are types of observables, like 21 centimeter fluctuations during the Dark Ages, that in principle can see all of them. And if you take sort of a long-term historical perspective where in 1990 we had basically measured zero modes, we hadn't detected anisotropy in the CMB yet, there's sort of been a steady Moore's law progression where you know, an exponentially increasing function of time. I don't think it's totally, people have different opinions, but I personally don't think it's totally insane to think about one day measuring this. It would be fantastic. That would be sort of the ultimate measurement of single field inflation. We would see its self-interactions in correlations on our sky, the same way in particle physics you can look for, you know, detailed k-dependence of a scattering amplitude and confirm single field inflation. But it's a long way off. In the next, so at least in the for now and in the short-term future, the prediction of single-field slow roll inflation is a negligible, a three deviations from Gaussian statistics of negligible statistical significance. In the next lecture, we're going to start looking at alternate models, which are not single-field slow roll, that do have interesting non-Gaussian phenomenology. See you next week.